Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stosh Zielkowski.
And this is Monday, March 20th, 2023.
Wow, and I see we've started off in an interesting way. Why are you laughing when I say my name?
Because I'm laughing at myself because I forgot who I was for a minute.
I thought that
how are
you look puzzled.
Yes, I am puzzled. Perpetually puzzled.
Okay.
Our theme today is celebrating Women's History Month, part 3. We're keeping this going.
Yes.
And we have some interesting history for you today. I want to thank Andy Offit Irwin for opening our show with Tarry Here. And I am going to tell you a bit about Stories in the Round coming up. I don't have the full roster, but we are beginning our new season on April 24th with Susan Gordon, who will be our opening act. And
wow.
I'm really excited about that. I was hoping she would agree, and she did. And she's going to be featuring her new novel in process, Laurel Fork, about Liza. And she's going to share with us both the research that she did to get this novel underway and the people that helped her with West Virginia history and the stories related to the Cheat River there. Because this novel about Liza involves Liza walking a good section of West Virginia during the early 20th century, when a good section of the Allegheny Mountains had been clear cut by lumber companies. And Susan's going to share the research and a part of the novel. She's actually going to read a good section of the novel for us.
Do you have any others listed?
I do, but I'm not going to share them yet because I don't have their contracts in hand. So, but you will be hearing.
I hope so.
Okay. Tell us about Speak, Stosh.
Well, we just, last week we had a wonderful 2 days of Connie Reagan Blake, who spoke on Tuesday, March 14th, about Ray Hicks, and gave a wonderful performance and told about his life as a son, as a father, as a husband, and mostly as a storyteller. And I'm hoping that maybe next week I'll be able to play a bit of a CD with Ray Hicks performing a Jack tale, not the entire tale, but we could talk about that, but a Jack tale that, so that people would get to hear the wonderful way Ray Hicks' voice sounded, because he spoke, it was written up in stories about him that it sounded like an Elizabethan English. And I have to say, the first time I played a CD of Ray, I just sat and stared and said, I better listen to that again and again, because some of the words he said just didn't sound like words I would be able to decipher. And anyway, Connie appeared on stage on March 14th, with a large banner, a life-size portrait of Ray Hicks, and it gave the audience a real good picture of what it was like to stand next to Ray. He was 6'7" tall. And then on Wednesday, Connie went to Morgan Academy, she went to Shepherdstown Middle School. I was in a time zone there, and where she entertained 150 plus sixth graders. And she had so much fun. She said she was going to start doing more schools, even though she's done hundreds and hundreds of schools in her career. In the last 4 or 5 years, she said she had kind of been so busy with festivals and things, she hadn't done many schools, but she had a great time. And on Wednesday, the 15th, she entertained an audience in person on the stage at the Shepherdstown University at one of their theater buildings, because the space at Shepherdstown Opera House was not quite ready and had some problems with technical things, mostly with sound and video. So we hope to be back in there in April, when we will have Carmen Agra Didi, April 11th and 12th. And if you've never heard Carmen, you should get a good seat. Make sure your feet are on the floor, because she'll knock you right off your feet. She's a wonderful performer.
Yes.
And you can get all the information that you would ever need by going to speakstoryseries.com. And you can even get a season ticket there, or individual tickets. The Tuesday night conference, Tuesday night performance is live and on Zoom, but the Wednesday performance is only live. So there we are.
Carmen Didi is one of my favorite show women. She does such a great job up on stage. She's so funny. And there's always a really heartwarming message with her stories. She's just charming up on stage.
Can you give me a time check?
Right now?
Yes.
I would say 4 minutes.
Okay.
But thank you for saying that.
Right.
Because I was so absorbed in listening to you that I did not set my own timer.
Okay. All right. I just want to be sure. Okay, so I think we're ready to begin.
And I did want to say that Connie Reagan Blake did an amazing job for the Wednesday show that I saw. I was not there for Tuesday, but
right.
Wednesday was just heartwarming.
Right, and it was great for me and my wife to see Connie, because she had been in the first festival in Arkansas when I started the festival there in 2010. She was the first person I hired for that festival, and she did a marvelous job there, and we had a nice time reminiscing about some of those things. And when she went back home, I got a nice email from her where she asked me to comment on her performance about Ray Hicks and to make suggestions about that performance, and so for about 7 seconds or so, I walked around with my chest puffed out, and my head up in the air, feeling like I was an important person. And I did write her comments, and one of the things I said was she should, anytime she performs a story of Ray Hicks, that banner should be on stage right next to her. So, and she should also, I suggested that she should play a clip of him telling the story, a Jack tale, so that the audience would get a real feel, not only for hearing her tell about his voice and his language, but they would get a feel for this man who was extremely important in storytelling and was one of the leaders, probably the most important leader in the revival of storytelling in this country and around the world.
Yes, she is. I really enjoyed my time with her. And you know, I take notes when I listen to storytelling, as you have many times commented. And Connie asked if I would type up my notes for her. So I'm going to do that and share her.
Well, that's good. Yeah, that's
my good version.
Yeah, I noticed your notes. And you did over 1,400 words. It was very good.
You counted every one, right?
Well, you know me, I like numbers. So
okay. Us into women's history, Stosh.
Okay. Women's history in part three. One of the things in my research, they found out that there are 13 things that women can do now that they couldn't do in early part of our country, and of course in many places around the world, but this is featuring on the United States. 13 things that women could not do back in the early 1800s, and some even coming forward to present day. But here we go. Number one, women weren't allowed to vote. And that wasn't changed until 1920. I believe, and that was in our country with the 19th Amendment. Women could not make use of any kind of birth control. Women could not get a divorce. It was interesting that there were many, many states who had part of their law about a woman seeking a divorce. There are some states who had a number of incidents of physical abuse by the husband before the woman could even approach court. So in some states, a woman had to be physically abused 3 times before she could go to court and request a divorce. And even then, that wasn't guaranteed. Women could not wear pants. Women could not be in the military. Even though there were women that served, helped in things like the Civil War in our country, they could not be in the military as a military entity. They had to be a volunteer. They didn't get paid. Women could not keep their maiden name. And I know that that has gone away because both my daughters have kept their maiden name and they've been married for a while. Women could not smoke in public. They could not own property if they were married. A woman who was single could own property, but if a woman was married, the husband owned the property. They could also, at one time in this country, they could not go out and do any shopping without an escort, a male escort, of course. There were many places where women could not work what the legitimate number of hours was considered. There were many businesses that would force a woman to work longer than 10 hours a day, even though their contract or whatever from the business would say that that's what the work shift was. But that was changed so that they couldn't be forced to work more than 10 hours. I believe some people now, both men and women, have jobs where they do wind up having to work more than the legal number of hours or more than what they were hired for because of business nowadays. Women were not allowed to serve on a jury. They were not allowed to compete in many Olympic sports. In my own lifetime and yours, women were not allowed to run in track and field. Women were not allowed to run in a race that was longer than 800 meters. as a young track coach. I coached, started a girls program in a high school and in the county where I was working. And the girls I coached were not allowed to run more than one event in the first year that we had them competing, which was really silly. And that rule actually applied to the young men also. Women were not allowed to have their own passport. If they had a passport, it was attached to their husbands. So that is like the, to me, that we could call that the deadly 13, because they're just horrible things to ask, you know, somebody to do or not do. Okay, so I want to tell you about Rose O'Neill. That I would guess that she was Irish. What an absolute perfect name for an Irish lady. Born into poverty in Omaha, Nebraska in 1974, Rose O'Neill grew up to be one of America's most important political cartoonists. She was the only woman on the editorial staff of Puck magazine in the late 1800s. She shot to fame after introducing the Kewpie characters in 1909 in Ladies' Home Journal, in the Kewpie Primer. O'Neill described Kewpies as a benevolent elf who did good deeds in a funny way. Creative talent and invention were just the beginning of this remarkable woman's skills. O'Neill was a brilliant marketer also, and Kewpie became the most popular cartoon character in the world until Mickey Mouse came along. Not only did she turn them into a massive profitable industry patented long before Barbie, she used their popularity to promote women's suffrage in her political cartoons and talk about issues like racism and segregation. Rose O'Neill was way ahead of her time, and it is about time more people know about her. It's hard to imagine that she was one of the people who focused on the 13 things that women weren't allowed to do in those days. There you go. That is my short story to open up our show today, so that you have plenty of time to concentrate on your story. And I'll come back later with another one.
That was wonderful, Stosh. And I'm as impressive as this woman is, as Rose O'Neill is, and the fact that she was a political cartoonist, I'm bereft that I am only hearing about her now. So I will read up and see if I can find some of her work.
Right.
And learn more about her.
And I'll tell you a good place to look, and that's the internet.
Oh, really?
Yes.
This is a new discovery for you.
Well, I do a lot of research on the internet. I was very pleased that I had no trouble at all finding all kind of information about women and that in my little phone.
My problem is that I start with the internet and then I go to Abe Books and all of the rare books that are available and historical texts is just fascinating to me.
And really? Is that on the internet?
Yep.
Abe Books. I'll have to admit, I'd never heard of it.
You should check it out. Right. It's really wonderful.
Right. I do have a rare book or two.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing about those at some point. Well, you'll have to tell me what your topic is so we can build a theme around them.
There you go.
Okay, well, I'm going to invite my great-grandfather, T.H. Barnes, to come into my branch of the studio, of the radio studio, and talk about women's history. So let me go and get great-grandpa.
All right. And let's see. I guess I could mention who's coming in April to Stories in the Round. Could I do that?
Yes. Please do that, Mr. Z.
Okay. Well, here's Mr. Barnes, so I will not interfere with your time. Mr. Barnes, it's good to see you again and to hear you.
Thank you, Mr. Zilkowski. I have been looking forward to getting to speak to you today and to speak to your listeners. It's always an honor for me to join you and that girl, my great-granddaughter. She keeps disappearing. I always think she's going to sit with me and listen to my stories, and she just disappears right away. Yeah. Well, good afternoon. And, I guess it is still morning. She tells me we're recording now, but
yes,
we're not live. Is that what I hear? My goodness gracious. Well, today, Monday, March 20th, 1942, I am grateful for this opportunity once again to join you. You know, I always say Anno Domini because that means the year of our Lord, and it's 1,992 years since the year of our Lord. You'll have to pardon me. I do love language, and I know you are a mathematician, Mr. Z, and I certainly would not claim that label, that honorific. But it is a gift to be asked to share a few of my personal memories, family stories, and historical events. As I've experienced them in my 92 years. Now, I've been asked by my great-granddaughter to share my thoughts about women's history today. This is not a new topic for me, as far as internal consideration is concerned or sharing thoughts within my family, but it is a new topic as far as any public declarations, public conversations. And so it's an opportunity for me to think more deeply myself about this topic. Of course, my name is Thomas Henry Barnes, often called T.H. by my family, sometimes embarrassingly called Tommy by the city fathers of Olean, New York, where I live. But it is a grand honor to speak into a microphone here at this radio station on this historic topic. I don't claim to be an historian. I'm a small town businessman. A barber. Still have a barber shop, of course, in my home at this time. But I am very interested in history, and you may have heard me talk about the library that I maintained in my shop when I was downtown in Olean. One, the longest wall of the barber shop was dedicated to a lending library. And I still have many of those books in my home. You've heard me tell the story of my early life and something of my parents. I've shared my father's story here on the radio many times. My father, Henry, was a dark-skinned man born into slavery in Virginia about 1818 and taken from his father and mother on that plantation as a small boy by a wealthy Englishman calling himself Reverend Barnes. You've heard me tell of my father's education, training as a gardener and a seed man, and his escape out of slavery and how he settled in Lewistown, Pennsylvania, Mifflin County, a known station on the Underground Railroad. Now, Henry found lucrative employment there and friends among the townsfolk, eventually marrying a freeborn local woman, Jane Williams. Together they started our family, five children, though only myself and my brother Peter survived beyond 5 years. My father knew very little of his parents taken so young, and I've remember nothing that my father has said about his father, but he did say that when he was taken from his Virginia home, a woman he remembered as his mother gave him a small quilt to carry away with him when he was taken from her as a boy. And my father told me she gave him that quilt so that he would remember where he came from. And that story is evocative to me, and I believe another word would be iconic, in that it makes clear, made clear to me as a child, the importance of the presence and protection of women, mothers, and other family members, teachers, friends, protectors, advocates, who have helped shape my life, supported and inspired me to whatever I can claim as accomplishments in my life so far. Starting with my mother, Jane Williams Barnes, the politician of the family, I always say. And though her schooling was very limited, my mother was a natural mathematician with a wonderful memory of dates, details, names. She was enthusiastic on the subjects of education, politics, temperance, and well posted on the national questions of the time. She taught me the importance of language. My earliest memories of concern for language begin with my mother. Now, today you may be surprised to hear me use various ways to say colored or Negro, persons of African descent, black, perhaps shocking to your educated ears here, nigger. Well, at the end of the evening, I would be interested to hear your comments on my word choices, including yours, Mr. Z. We are all trying to improve communications. Yes? I certainly am. Yes. Well, I attended a small, dilapidated, one-room school with no books and almost nothing passing for educational supplies in my earliest educational experiences. But I learned the rudiments of reading. My mother was determined that I should have a clear understanding of the world around me. And to her, I owe my curiosity about people and life in general. She daily shared with me the secrets of mathematics and the importance of reading books, if available, but mostly newspapers and other small publications of our community. Mother did not read well, just enough to sound out the major headlines. But as my father would read the paper to us all regularly, those news stories were a regular part of our family conversations. Young as I was, I saw and heard much that deeply interested me. Mother taught me to listen to the words of others, to attend to their actions, and try to make sense of the needs and desires motivating men and women, yes, children around us. She gave me my first lessons in politics, making me a perpetual Republican. I have a vivid memory of watching the parades with Brother Peter during the election campaigns of 1856, before the Civil War. Brass bands, banners flying, throwing my cap in the air. "Make a joyful noise, Tommy," were Mother's instructions. And the Republican marchers in the parade threw large copper cents to us as they waved, passing our gate. These were the supporters of the former Vice President Millard Fillmore, then running for president. Mother explained these men supported schools for colored people, many willing to speak out for abolition of slavery throughout the country. Days later, Mother forced me and Peter into the house, locked the doors, drew the curtains as the second procession passed. I tried to remain by the window to observe, but Mother pulled me back as derisive epithets and showers of stones were hurled at our front door. Mother explained these marchers were Southern sympathizers who wrote in the newspapers that colored people were not human and deserved neither education nor citizenship. She bade me look round at our hard-working, kind, generous colored neighbors for evidence to the contrary. The apologist for slavery, James Buchanan, was elected in 1856, of course, and as he was born and raised in Franklin County, Pennsylvania, not far away, our local newspaper reported almost everything he said or did. Well, not like today, 1942, with newsreels and radio replaying speeches every evening. But those election parades, the political hullabaloo, is still so vivid to me, these 80-some years later. It was likely the start of my interest in reading about politics and history. My mother's enthusiasm for teaching me the lessons of history and politics remain with me as a beacon of my mother's concern for my education and place in our community, rich with examples of the power of leaders to galvanize ordinary citizens for right or wrong. Now, there is another election, I'll just mention this quickly, after the Civil War that captured my attention for an entirely different reason. During the election campaigns of 1872, after the awful misery and destruction of the Civil War, for General Ulysses Grant's second run for the presidency, a white woman named Victoria Woodhull, suffragist, a voting rights advocate for women's rights first, but she did not neglect the importance of Negro suffrage. Of course, women, neither white nor Negro, could vote at that time, and the women suffragists were considered radical by many. Victoria Woodhull had the audacity to declare herself a candidate for the presidency. She was not even old enough, according to the constitutionally mandated age restrictions. Her 35th birthday would not occur until September of 1873, after the March inauguration. She was already well known as an activist for women's rights, by which she meant the freedom to marry, divorce, and bear children without government interference. Now, the newspapers called this free love, and that was a fair term, I suppose, at the time. And the newspapers later widely publicized her detailed account of an article claiming that the minister, Henry Ward Beecher, you may know him as the brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin, that book you've likely heard about, that Henry Ward Beecher had conducted an adulterous affair with another woman suffragist. But I didn't come in today to talk about that. What was most memorable to me at the time was that when the Equal Rights Party, a party in support of women's suffrage and most of the time in support of Negro suffrage, nominated Victoria Woodhull for president, they also named Frederick Douglass for vice president. Now, Mr. Douglass never accepted or even acknowledged the nomination. He remained a strong supporter of General Grant to lead the country. But it was an interesting campaign. Grant did win in a landslide against both the Equal Rights Party and the Democratic Party candidate, Horace Greeley, editor for the New York Tribune, and who used his newspaper to oppose Southern Reconstruction. He was another Southern sympathizer. Now, I wanted to mention briefly my time as a child in the New York Colored Orphans Asylum in New York City, because there were several women at that institution who had an impact on my life then and now. My father died when I was but 8 years old, quick consumption, or you would say pneumonia. Perhaps working outdoors winter and summer, barely any accommodation for foul weather or health emergencies contributed to his early death at 39 years. But mother had a difficult time then. She was ill herself more than a year and lived just 3 years without him. The night he died, mother gone, I well understood we were orphans, Brother Peter and myself. Her last words to me were, "Be a good boy, as I taught you. Take care of your brother." Brother Peter and I were rescued by mother's brother, our beloved Uncle Peter, his wife Aunt Caroline, with their daughters Lizzie and Sadie, who took me and Peter to live with them in Brooklyn, New York. The difficulty there was, though Cousin Lizzie, diligent and talented music student, and my witty and fun-loving cousin Sadie were accepted in the local white school, they were light-complexioned, while Peter and myself were obviously colored children unacceptable to that school. And Brooklyn, mostly rural at the time, had no other options. Uncle and Aunt determined to ensure our education by enrolling Brother Peter and me in the New York Colored Orphans Asylum in Manhattan, paying $1.50 per child per week, a substantial sum at the time, to ensure our status as half orphans, meaning we could be brought home to Brooklyn whenever convenient. Now, the founder of that institution, the co-founder, Miss Anna Shotwell, and her partner in that development of that institution, Hannah Murray, changed my life. My life and Brother Peter's life, and that of thousands of other young Black children, mostly freeborn. Anna Shotwell was responsible for the rescue of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of children, even before I arrived there in 1860. There were many Black children living on the street. There were those living in families who could barely support them and certainly had no resources to educate them, even within the city of New York. Anna Shotwell took a special shine to me, you would say, partly, I think, because we had Brother Peter and I had been gently reared, if you could say that, and we had been educated to a certain extent. And so in some ways we stood out among the street children who came to live at the institution. Miss Anna took a special interest in me. When I was older there, I was often sent on errands to Miss Anna's house. She was largely responsible for allowing me to compete in a competition for scholarship to Oberlin College in Ohio, a competition that I won and was invited to apply to attend there. But in the meantime, I had decided that I was not going to leave my brother Peter and that I wanted to remain in the New York City area closer to Aunt Caroline and Uncle Peter and my cousins. Of course, there was all sorts of other tragedies and traumas going on at the institution brought on by the Civil War. The orphanage was burned to the ground in 1863, and we children were moved to another location that was not really adequate for us, and a large fraction of the inmates came down with terrible diseases. I myself had typhoid fever. The nurses there, all women, were largely responsible for my life being saved, because many, many other children died that winter. But the personage, the woman that I most wanted to talk to you about today was Ida Bell Wells Barnett. Now, if you are a follower of great women, you probably know her as Ida B. Wells, as she has been famous in the United States, even notorious in the very best sense of the word, since long before her marriage to Mr. Ferdinand Barnett. She was a newspaper reporter and then editor of the newspaper she started herself, the Free Speech and Headlight newspaper. Until Southern sympathizers became alarmed that she was actually changing the political tide, influencing white newspapers to pick up on the horrifying statistics on the Reign of Terror in the former Confederate states. This was after the Civil War, and in many places in the northern states, with the intention of maintaining this Reign of Terror, whose intention was to maintain the power and status, economic, social, and political supremacy of white Americans. Primarily in the South, but not confined to the South. Now, Ida Wells was born in 1862, and I regret to inform you that she has already been gone from this earth more than a decade. But she died in 1931. But she was an American investigative journalist, one of the first and one of the most effective. She was an educator and one of the founders of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, another influential organization. She dedicated her life to fighting prejudice and fighting violence against African descended Americans, especially women. And she became arguably the most famous Black woman in the United States at the time. She was born enslaved in Mississippi. She was freed by the Emancipation Proclamation during the Civil War. But as a young teenager, she lost most of her family in the yellow fever outbreak in the South, and she went to work then to keep the rest of the family together. She did have the help of her grandmother, and she moved her siblings into Tennessee when she found better pay there as a teacher. That's where she founded the Memphis Free Speech and Headlight newspaper. And that's where she began covering these terroristic incidents specifically lynching, but that was not the only tragedy that she covered. We had some record of a lynching within my own family. My daughter, Mabel Cinderella Barnes, married a man named John Crawford, and my great-granddaughter, who's here with me today, knows a little bit more about this. She says she has researched it, but one of John Crawford's uncles, Anthony Crawford, was lynched some time back. We don't have a lot of information about that. I hope that my great-granddaughter is able to do more research. I'm trying to spread the word about Ida Wells because she's not spoken about that often these days. And she was ahead of her time, meaning that she was regularly attacked and disapproved of in public, especially by the white press. But she was pushing people to understand and accept the realities around them. She was active in the civil rights movement and women's suffrage movement, and she was a wonderful speaker. I never heard her speak myself, but I regularly read the things she wrote, and she impressed me early on. Her two small but powerful, very powerful publications are entitled Southern Horrors and The Red Record, where she investigated lynchings that she heard about, where, you know, Black people were accused of being criminals, but really there was a campaign of terror going on to prevent economic and political competition to maintain the white power structure. Her newspaper was destroyed, and she eventually she fled Memphis with threats on her life, and thereafter settled in Chicago, and that's where most people know as her home. So I'm still trying to figure out how to talk about Ida B. Wells in ways that does her credit and also makes clear to audiences what a powerful person she was in explaining that this pattern of defending white women's honor while murdering innocent Black men, and how that could serve as a smokescreen for the sexual violence on Black women by white men. This is talk that's difficult to talk about publicly. And I'm struggling with this, but I thought I would take this opportunity with a sympathetic audience to try out some of this conversation. Thank you, Mr. Zielkowski, and I will find my granddaughter and hope she's not too distressed with me for sharing all this information. We have had these conversations, but I'm not sure she understood that I was going to talk about this on the radio today, so I might hear about it later.
Thank you, Mr. Barnes. It's always a pleasure to have you with us.
All right. I'm going to go find that girl.
Okay. You've been listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour, and this is Stacia Olkowski and my partner,
Fanny Crawford.
There she is. She's back. So, Fanny. All right. Well, that was enlightening to hear. I heard some things there I never heard before.
Well, what did Grandpa say? I'm a little I'm a little worried about what you're going to tell me.
Oh, well, he didn't say anything that I thought was shocking. It's shocking to someone who would be ignorant of the some of the history of our country. And it should be shocking, actually, because he mentioned a number of women who were influential in his life and in the life of many people in this country. And he spoke for, you'll be surprised to know, he spoke for 28 minutes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. He was, and
I guess it runs in the family, huh?
Well, you know, and it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with that, you know, because he is a wonderful speaker. I am always shocked when I hear someone use the some of the words to describe Black people. And of course, I've heard him use the, some of those words before. I'm not so sure even, I think of myself as a very modern person, but I do not understand why anybody uses the what was referred to as the N-word, unless it is in a, you know, in a classical kind of descriptive volume, I guess, historical type thing. I just think it's a word that should be banished from our language because it is so, to me, it's a horrible word. And I'm proud to say I've never used it in a derogatory way. When I was a young person, I heard it frequently because where I grew up, Baltimore. Anyway, that's just a personal view of mine. I do not understand why people do that. I do understand why young people pick up something like that, because young people think things are funny that aren't really funny sometimes. They make fun of people who have handicaps or look different. It's always what I think, the others, instead of just saying who the others are to make up derogatory terms. It's always, to me, has always been poor use of language. If you can't say, think of something better to say about somebody, don't say anything. I was taught that as a young child.
So did great grandpa say anything? Was his language disturbing today?
No, only that. I don't like to hear that one particular word, but he didn't in any way say it offensively. It was just in a statement of the language, you know, how African Americans have been called different names, and I. Even in my experience, especially when I was in the Army, I heard people defend the use of those kind of words because that's the way they were taught. Mm-hmm. I served in the Army with 50%, at least 50% of my basic training company were from the South. And so that was some education. I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland. And that's considered being in the South by many people. And of course, Maryland was one of the states that was a free state. However, people of color were not treated any better there than they would have been down in Alabama or Georgia. But I spent a lot of time in 10 weeks of basic training, hearing lots of things about, Black people that I didn't hear in my normal life before that. And it was interesting. Not all the Southern men I met in the Army, certainly most of them, did not disparage Black people or say terrible things and wish terrible things on them. a military company has a way of taking different people and blending them into an outfit that are supposed to be ready to fight for our country and for each other. And in my experience, in my only 3 years in the Army, it was, I thought it did quite well. The military did build some real relationships that were positive between black and white. Not perfectly, but much better than in many other places. So, and as usual, I was always glad to hear Mr. Barnes speaking.
Okay. Thank you, Stosh.
You're very welcome.
You have another story for us. For
I do have another story. I have a story about a lady by the, I love this name, Annie Jump Cannon. And when I first read that name, I thought to myself, I hope that's not because she jumped over cannons or something like that. That middle name was a family name also. But it is a strange one when you put it like that. Originally, she was hired as a female computer. The term used in the late 19th century for those who did calculations. Annie Jump Cannon performed unspecialized and tedious work, but her legacy would soon be written in the stars. My background as a teacher, for a while I taught astronomy, and I also ran a planetarium. So I was really interested in this lady because of her influence. The Cannon is the astronomer best known for coming up with the current system of stellar classification. Her system, ranking stars as, oh, and these are capital letters, O, B, A, F, C, no, F, G, K, or M. Can't read my own writing sometime. With O being the hottest stars and M the coolest. The sun is a G star. Our sun is a G star. This classification is still used today. The way that letter sequence is easily remembered is also credited to her because she created a saying, O, be a fine girl, kiss me. I like it when people have sentences or statements that the first letter of each of the words helps them to remember something like, people who learn to play the guitar can tell you that every good boy does fine stuff for the guitar strings, pitches, I guess. Over the course of Annie's distinguished life, she classified the spectra of over 350,000 stars. If I had read that when I was a young person, I would have thought, how could that be possible? I go out at night and look around, I can't find more than a couple hundred stars up there. Of course, she was using the telescope, and I didn't have a telescope. And once, first time I looked through a telescope, I remember being absolutely amazed, because there were stars in places I couldn't see.
Say that number again, Stosh.
350,000 stars. She classified them according to their her system. Legend has it that she could look at any stellar spectra and classify it in just 3 seconds. I don't know. I couldn't challenge something like that, because anyone who's done 350,000 of anything has to be way, way up the road ahead of me. So, yet the man in charge at the Harvard Observatory has had more ink spilled in his honor. Again, according to space.com, while Cannon was one of the more famous female computers at Harvard, critics note that Edward Charles Pickering, and I come across his name a lot in my early studies, the rector of the Harvard College Observatory, received much more credit than they did. Pickering was highly decorated in his lifetime, and there are craters named after him on the moon and Mars. Meanwhile, Annie Jump Cannon's enduring achievement was dubbed the Harvard Not the Cannon system of spectral classification. Cannon is the poster child of a remarkable woman, for a remarkable woman who got squeezed out of male-written and male-dominated history books. Check out these history lessons your teacher lied to you about in school. I like that. Check out these history lessons your teacher lied to you about in school. Because, you know, teachers often, in their preparation, college preparation, getting a degree as a teacher, go by the popular books. And the colleges promote, still today, lots of male accomplishments over female accomplishments. Just because it's been that way for a long time and continues that way. One of the things I am so happy to see in, as far as accomplishments go, is nowadays in, you know, I like sports. And nowadays, if you watch a football game or what's going on presently is the national championship for college basketball for men's, and women's has also started. The men's will finish first, but there are sideline reporters. There are people who are experts on the game who sit on panels on the main television stations and discuss, lead the discussion about the basketball players, about the coaches, about the teams and the colleges. And that is just absolutely wonderful, because when I was a young man, there were no women reporters in sports. Not on the television screens that I watched, of course. And there probably were some, but certainly not like today. And they have sideline reporters on every football game that are women. The other thing that they have in sports nowadays that is shows that some men, many men, have awakened is that there are actual referees in the National Football League that are women. The first time I saw a woman, a lady with a ponytail walk across, sticking out of her hat, walk across the field to talk to one of the coaches, I was, even though I'd heard of it, I'd never seen a woman on the football field before, and stand there and go toe-to-toe with the coach and explain to him why his player was being charged with some kind of foul or something like that. And I think it's wonderful. As a father of two girls, I've always been a supporter of women, and I hope that anybody else that has ever met me would know that that's true. So thank you to Rosa Neal and Annie Jump Cannon.
Wow. Well, you've definitely educated me to people that I knew nothing about, and I'm happy to know, and I'll have to do some research myself.
Yep. That's a good idea, I think. And yeah, I believe we're not worried, because people could listen to us for hours.
Oh, of but, course. Well,
we have been on this broadcast now for an hour.
Okay, well then I guess we better close out.
I think so.
This is Fanny Crawford.
And Stosh Zielkowski.
Your co-hosts for the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. We are independent community radio in Bolivar, West Virginia, Martinsburg, West Virginia, and Hagerstown, Maryland. And it's time to end. We offer listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. What's up next? John.
Smooth jazz. Very, very, very smooth jazz.
Very, very smooth jazz.
Yes, right. You won't be able to use the music as an excuse to not do your work.